Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for June 30th, 2017. This is clarinetist Richard Stoltzman in a piece by Francis Poulenc, and it's a very small part of a 40-CD set of recordings by Stoltzman that's just been released by Sony. My colleague Kathy Fuller talked with Richard Stoltzman about that set and about his life in music, and I have the final part of their conversation on this podcast. And for the first two parts, by the way, just check out the most recent two episodes of The Answered Question. Also on the podcast is a conversation with Andrea Avery, the author of Sonata, a memoir of pain and piano, which was just published a couple of months ago. And before we dive into these two conversations, one quick note about this podcast. It's summer, and The Answered Question is going on vacation, so keep your subscription open and look for the next episode later this year in the fall. When Andrea Avery published Sonata, a memoir of pain and piano, it caught the eye of my colleague Chris Voss, who's on the air on WCRB each weekday from 2 to 7 o'clock. And earlier this week, Andrea and Chris got together to talk about the book and the experiences that led to it. As a child, Andrea was a serious piano student when she was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, a crippling condition. So Chris began by asking Andrea to simply explain what the disease is, and especially how it's different from what most people think of when they hear the word arthritis.
It has the name arthritis, and so people associate it with a geriatric illness or a wear and tear kind of orthopedic. You were a football player in high school and you have a bum knee kind of thing. So an overuse kind of mechanical illness. But rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease. And while it has mechanical manifestations, it's really more akin to multiple sclerosis or lupus or fibromyalgia or, you know, some of these other more systemic diseases. So what happens in rheumatoid arthritis is something triggers a reaction in your immune system to make it freak out and overreact. And it begins a kind of multi-site assault. And the primary site of those that assault is the joints and the linings of the joints. And that's where you get the arthritic symptoms that you would recognize, joint pain and stiffness and swelling. But as a more systemic disease, it can affect many other tissues and systems. There can be complications with your heart. There can be complications with your eyes. I've been lucky not to have too terribly many of those complications. But it's a serious and really profoundly crippling disease that more people suffer from than you might know. My experience of it was a little bit unusual in the sense that while there is a juvenile form of arthritis, I actually was very proud to get the adult version early. So I got an adult onset rheumatoid arthritis, which people would expect to see in ages 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, but I got it at 12. And even then, and still, I'm a little bit kind of perversely proud of the fact that I got the kind of unabridged adult version a little bit early.
And it sort of hit you right as you were coming into your own as a pianist.
Yeah, and you know, that's not atypical also for juvenile arthritis or rheumatoid arthritis, that it corresponds with a period in your life where your body's changing a lot, puberty. So there's kind of these hormonal changes. But, you know, around age 12, 13, 14 is often where a person is starting to kind of make the bridge from a thing you're pretty good at as a kid to a thing that could be a viable occupation or a course you could chase for real. And so rheumatoid arthritis landed in my life when I was kind of at that tender spot where piano is what I love and it's what I want to do. But wait, seriously, like college, could I really? Is it really something I could do? So it's kind of an unfortunate convergence of extraordinarinesses in my life.
I love how the book is structured. It's structured like a classical piece of music in movements, and each movement sort of goes through a different part of your life, as I understand it.
Yeah.
And the first movement being sort of joyful and childlike, yeah, and then progressing.
Yeah, and I picture it sort of it gets kind of dark in the middle, and maybe, but then I think hopefully it emerges into a more jubilant kind of movement at the end, which, as you know, many, many multi-movement works do.
I wanted to have you read a little bit from the early bit of the book, from when you first came across the Schubert 21st Piano Sonata of the B-flat.
Okay, fantastic. In 1991, at the conference in Providence, Rhode Island, I'd attended an art therapy session for us kids with arthritis, which was actually just a stack of construction paper, Elmer's glue, crayons, and tape left in the middle of a folding table in an otherwise empty banquet room where someone in an Arthritis Foundation polo shirt stood nearby and didn't say or do anything. I'm not saying it wasn't therapeutic. I cut and glued and colored silently alongside other arthritic kids. A boombox in the corner was set to a classical music station, and a piano piece caught my attention, and I boasted to anyone who was listening, "I can play this." I'd never heard it before, but I loved it immediately. It began with a far-off melody in a middle register, a major key melody that sounds like someone absent-mindedly humming a snippet of a remembered song. The melody lifts and falls to a pause as the hummer remembers more and more of the song. Then there is an ominous rumble from the low end of the piano, a note that doesn't really seem to fit. And the melody returns in a minor key, and the rumbling turns into triplets in the left hand against the right hand's eighth notes. I needed to know what this music was and who wrote it. People sometimes say that a pair of shoes in a department store or a puppy at the pound spoke to them. That's what this was. I needed to get it home and try it on, nuzzle its neck. At the end of the piece, the announcer said it was Schubert's Sonata in B-flat, D960, and I committed that all to memory the way I'd committed Tony McComas's phone number to memory when he gave it to me after Sunday school one day, and I made a mental vow to get the music and make good on my boasting.
Did make good on your boasting.
I did. That instance of boasting, there's plenty of boasting I've done in my life on which I have not made good.
But the Schubert has been with you throughout your life,
yeah,
still to this day.
It's kind of I don't know what to call it. It's this accompaniment, which to use, you know, once you start paying attention to the way that musical terminology is in all of our other language, so it's been my accompanist. Yeah, I chased that sonata as the piece I wanted to play and to cultivate and you know, mainly so I could just sound like that. I mean, what musician doesn't listen to music and think, I want to be like that? So I wanted to sound, initially, I wanted to sound like what I'd heard on the radio. But that piece of music, I experienced it differently than I had any other piece of music. Before that, I was, you know, pretty good at getting a piece of music, learning it, performing it, getting a prize or a ribbon or whatever, and moving on. But this one wasn't so easy to move on from. And it also wasn't so easy to, I couldn't make it sound the way I wanted to. There was this internal version of how I wanted it to sound and then what my hands were doing. And I found that with that piece of music, I needed to kind of study it more. I needed to listen and I needed to look at the manuscript and I needed to just kind of pore over it. And unlike other pieces that I'd sort of brashly cultivated and developed ready for performance, this one I kind of wanted to stoke and keep a little more private. I kind of maybe sensed that once you share it with the world, it's not completely just your own anymore.
Well, and it's one of Schubert's most deeply passionate and almost sad pieces of music in its happiness.
Yeah, and that I didn't know till much later. You know, I didn't know that. I didn't know anything about it as a piece of music or its spot in Schubert's catalog or in his life writing it until much, much, much later. You know, I approached it as a piece of piano literature, and it saw me through kind of the fizzled end of my piano career. And then it became a piece of history to study. And when I was writing this book, to go back to that sonata and to ask a different set of questions, why did this sonata speak to me when I was an ill child in a banquet room in a hotel in a city named, of all things, Providence? I mean, that's unbearably beautiful. When I learned that he was sick and dying as he wrote it, when I learned how it was regarded after his death by scholars and how it was sort of, you know, snobbishly disregarded. And then when I learned about sort of theoretic analysis of it, Joseph Strauss's book, Extraordinary Measures, and his analysis of that sonata as a kind of a musical treatment of disability that isn't resolved a la Beethoven, that isn't kind of fixed and made triumphant and recovered from, but disability that's accommodated and a piece of music is built with this harmonic kind of disability in it. I thought, oh my God, you know, 20 years ago I heard the sonata and I thought it was just a piece of music, and now I'm learning that all this has been written about it and said about it, and it's a parable for me. And that's what makes that piece of music bearable to listen to, even though sometimes other piano music is really painful for me to listen to, because that same itch I had at that table in that conference of, I can play this, I can inside, but my hands can't. But that piece of music, because of all this history and all the Schubert that goes around it, I still listen to it for comfort.
You talk about a lot of artists and musicians in the book that sort of like the Schubert have sort of an analogous story to yours. Do you feel that there's in musicians like Leon Fleischer, for example, or Byron Janis, who have this disease that affects their playing, that they can achieve something different through the music, and that you hear the music in the way that they hear the music?
I don't know. You know, that's a tricky question, because I don't know any of those pianists personally. I've never gotten to, as much as I've, you know, I've sent fan letters to Byron Janis. He hasn't written me back. So if you're listening. But I would love to, you know, in his biography, he talks about how, you know, he kept his arthritis secret for a long time, and he didn't want to betray the music by letting anyone know that it was produced by or created by an arthritic pianist. Because there is a tendency then, if you're a disabled musician, for this kind of discounting, that's pretty good for an arthritic pianist, or for someone with equipment that's damaged to make. And I know from his biography, having read that he didn't want that kind of qualification to be attached to the music he made, even though he did it with an arthritic body. I don't know if there's a kind of a subtextual pain and painfulness and then reception of pain that we kind of damaged pianists can hear in each other's work. I think there are certainly there's technical things. If your hands don't do the same things, you've got to figure out different ways to finger passages. You've got to figure out different ways to, you know, hold or transition from fingered chords or whatever. And I can't say that when I listen to piano music created by someone like Leon Fleischer or Byron Janis, I'm thinking, oh, I see what he did there to accommodate the lack of mobility in the third finger joint. You know, I'm not thinking that. And I think if you are thinking that when you're listening to music, you're doing it wrong, you know. So I don't know if there's a kind of a subtextual, almost like a radio signal that gets beamed out from a pained pianist to another. I do know that I hear piano music differently, I think, now that I can't. You know, a pianist tends to finger piano music on his or her jeans or tabletop, when I think you were doing that when I was describing the Schubert. Actually, I think I caught you. But my hands can't do that anymore. So that kind of keening, how would it feel to play this, has to happen all invisibly internally for me. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It absolutely does. And I think it actually transitions nicely into the second reading I would like to have you read, if you don't mind.
I would love to.
This is from the middle section of the book, which is much more pained and raw in the way that you go through this transition in your life from a pianist aspiring to then no more.
Ah, yes. As graduation approached, I reflected on my old childhood hero, Mozart, and the end of my own formal piano study. After falling for Schubert, I'd retired Mozart, stuffed him away like a plush toy I'd outgrown. But standing on the edge of adulthood, I longed for my old comforts, huggy, childhood Mozart. That last public concert of Mozart's, in which he played the piano concerto in B-flat, it was on March 4th, 1791, my birthday. To a girl born on Vivaldi's birthday, that's the kind of thing that feels like a sign. Then again, according to musicologist Alfred Einstein, Mozart's playing of the piano concerto in B-flat, why is all of my favorite music in B-flat, signified the end. It was not in the Requiem that he said his last word, however, but in this work. I graduated with a degree in music. That summer, my remaining music friends and I fled to the beach in Los Angeles for the week. In the company of Beth and Deanna, these two extraordinarily beautiful and talented saxophone players, one jazz and one classical, I felt like an imposter. I feared they saw me the way Wittgenstein's contemporaries saw the one-armed pianist, or, for that matter, the way many people view disabled people. Courageous, curious, freakish, feckless, virginal, vexing, pious, pesky. I knew my friends loved me and admired me for whatever limping music I was able to make against the odds, but I'm fairly certain they didn't see me as what I wanted to be, a pianist. I was unable to find solace or inspiration in Wittgenstein, or for that matter, in any of the other legendary musicians persevering despite disability stories that I knew of. Beethoven? Sure, he was deaf, but that happened gradually and didn't start until he was in his late 20s at least. He at least had a chance to get great before he started slipping. And there was Leon Fleischer, who lost the use of his right hand to dystonia in the 1960s and simply plugged ahead, playing all the left hand alone repertoire and conducting, which I hadn't been able to manage, until Rolfing and Botox delivered his right hand back to him. I should have been able to derive some inspiration from Byron Janis, himself a sufferer of arthritis. But Leon Fleischer, Beethoven, and Byron Janis had been granted something I envied. They had at least been given the chance to be great. Byron Janis's head start on arthritis was so much longer than my own. No one could dispute his greatness. He could always point to what he'd done and say, "Do you hear? That's me. All I have is a box of ribbons and trophies, a photo in a yearbook."
That moment in the book stuck. I think I closed the book after I read it because it is such a powerful discussion about your, okay, you've come to, you wanted this thing so badly.
Yeah.
But I was a singer before I came to do this radio thing. And when I sit in an audience and listen to a singer, I can feel my throat doing the things and missing it a little bit. Do you play piano at all? Do you sit down and tinker? Do you have the ability to do that?
Well, that's a question with a lot of different answers. It's very variable. If you'd asked me 2 years ago, I would say, yeah, I tinker and I can play and I not like I used to, and I choose different, you know, repertoire, and you know, suddenly Bartok is a lot more interesting to play because even though it's, you know, it's not flashy, I can use my brain and I can communicate between my brain and my fingers and I can do something. Right this second, the answer is a no, but not a forever no. I had a joint replacement surgery 2 summers ago in my shoulder and had a complication intraoperatively. I had a nerve injury. And so I lost all use of and sensation in my right arm. And so I could not lift a cup. I could not pinch. It was paralyzed for all intents and purposes. I spent that whole summer with a book called Handwriting for Heroes, learning to write with my left hand again. And so it's been 2 years since that event, almost to the day. It was June 30th, 2 years ago. And I still don't have sensation in two of my fingers on my right hand. And because my hand was immobilized because of the nerve injury for 6 weeks, I lost some range of motion in all the other fingers, because rheumatoid arthritis is very much a don't use it, lose it kind of disease. And so having my hand sort of on the injured list that stretch of time, I haven't quite bounced back from that yet. So right now, I can't do much of anything at the piano. I don't think I'm ready to say that it's over for goodsies. I'm totally silenced. I went to a dance performance a month or so ago that was featured Japanese dancers in middle age and American dancers in middle age. And it was the product of a piece of scholarship that a women's studies professor that I know and who I love and who helped me with this book a great deal, Rose Weitz, had gone as a sort of an attaché to this with these dance professors to Japan to examine the way that middle-aged Japanese dancers are treated and regarded in Japan versus middle-aged dancers in the United States. You know, dance is another field where your shelf life is
hit 30
short, and, right?
Yeah.
But they'd begun this research project to examine how that was regarded differently in Japan, and then the culmination of it was to bring these Japanese dancers back to the United States and have a performance. And one of the things that I think one of the Japanese dancers was quoted as talking about was that you cannot quit dancing. She had been attacked by a dog, I think, and had to stop dancing for a while, but she said she danced even with her fingertips just to be doing something, because if you let it go, if you stop, you'll stop. And that kind of horrified me, because I was sitting in this darkened dance hall thinking, I haven't touched the piano in months. I've stopped. And if I've stopped, I'll stop. And so I started really thinking that I should maybe take that piece of advice. And if one of my fingers can do something, if my thumb can play, can strike notes in succession, I should probably do that. Because I'm a little bit concerned that if I stop, I'll stop. And I'm not ready to let that go. I had an excerpt from the book Run in the Washington Post last week. And it got, I guess, I don't know what the word is, maybe syndicated. Or another newspaper ran it today. And of course, they put their own headline on it. And the headline that this paper put on today said, "A young pianist's dream dies," or something like that. And I couldn't resist. I commented. There's one comment. It's me. And I said, "I hope you read the book to find out that the dream isn't dead. It's transposed, or it's transformed, or it's whatever." I'm not ready to say it's dead. It's a little bit more like my playing the piano has been abducted, and I don't know if it's dead or alive. I don't know if it will come back to me. I don't know if it'll look like or sound like what I remember when it comes back to me. And you can see why that would put you in a painful, you know, if you have a child who's been carried off, being around other people with children would be painful. But it's this great, tender combination of both despair and hope. I'm not ready to say it's dead. That would be a closure, and I could get past that, but I'm not silenced entirely yet.
Do you feel you play in your head?
Oh, I do, and I have piano playing dreams all the time, which are wonderful because I wake up to having had this experience, this tactile auditory experience, but then also to discover that it didn't happen. Or, I mean, once music is done being played, it's just an idea anyway. So if I played in my dream, it echoes in my ears and in my head like a memory anyway. So maybe that's just as good. It's not just as good, but yeah, I do. I play in my head. I can, when I listen to piano music, I can sort of see it the way it would appear on the page. I still am very much a musician, but a musician who can't play music, I don't know what that is, you know? You're not an author if you read but don't write. You're a good reader, and those are super important, but you're not an author. I'm something in music based on the way I listen to it and the way I feel when I listen to it and how attentively I listen to it and what's going on inside my body and my mind when I listen to it, but I don't think it's a musician.
Yeah, I might argue with you on that. The way that you write about the music is so aware of the experience of being the musician that it is musical. You even write in the book about your writing as being a musical experience.
That was the concession that, you know, to lose the piano is a grievous loss in my life. It's hard. And when I felt myself sort of transitioning to writing, I said to myself, the only way I'll be okay with not being able to play the piano is if I can write about it, and if I can write about it well, and if I can get my story out. And I wanted this book to become a book that other people could read. And that will be the only thing that will make it okay if I can't play the piano anymore. But if that dream were to sort of die or be, you know, hobbled, I think that would have been unbearable. So the writing about music is, and you mentioned it being written in a musical form to movements, it's still important to me to be a composer and to be musical. And so to be able to try to write about it in a way that made that come alive and was musical to readers was the only way I was going to be okay with not being able to play piano.
I want to have you read the last reading because you mentioned the movements, and the book does have that upturn at the end that is, I mean, happily ever after is a stupid phrase, but it is this, you know, acceptance of your life. It is what it is, and you're going to take it as it comes one day at a time.
I love my life now.
I love your life. I felt unfair talking to you because I was like, I know so much more about you reading this book. It's so open than you know about me. So I feel like we'll have to reconcile
for
that
now.
At some
we'll
point.
Figure that yeah, out. Yeah. Get all your secrets out of you. Disease has changed me for good. It has formed my appetites and curiosities. I don't need to stalk my disease in operating rooms to see the full story, to understand it. It is always present. I cannot stand apart from my body. I am one thing, homogeneous, harmonious. It is me, and I am it. I am not my body, but neither is my disease. Arthritis shows up in my joints, but it is written into me at the most basic level. It's in my DNA. It is as much a part of the very fiber of me and as separate from the physical parts of me as my soul is. I am not afflicted. I am imbued. God is in the space between the molecules, and so is disease, and so is music. If music is in the spaces between the notes, then what happens if there are no notes at all? Can there be music? John Cage would say so. The absence of notes forces you to hear the music that is happening around you, despite you. Eventually, I brought Schubert in from the garage, but instead of playing the first movement, which had had a hold on my heart since I heard it in Providence almost 30 years ago, I turned to the second movement. This Andante Sostenuto movement in C sharp minor begins slowly, mournfully. I had time between key depressions to really hear the sounds, to plan where my hands would fall next. It is not flashy, but the 16th notes in the middle section in A major stopped me short. I could not simply sight read it, not with these uncooperative, out of practice hands. But there was a flutter in my chest. This was not out of reach. If I could practice, truly practice, in the way I never much wanted to as a child, I could play this. I could not believe I had overlooked this achingly beautiful Andante movement in my lust for the first movement.
You mentioned earlier, both in this and earlier, about the flashiness versus the being able to put your brain into that piece of music. How is, now that you're moving more towards Bartok and that kind of stuff, how is that different for you as a pianist?
Well, I think it's probably, maybe, I don't know. I don't want to speak for other people, but I think it's probably a process that happens to people as they age in general. I'm thinking about those middle-aged dancers or actresses who no longer play the love interest. You start to realize that you have to invest in the more durable cerebral parts of yourself, that bodies, whether you have rheumatoid arthritis or a chronic illness or a disability or not, bodies wear out and change, but you can cultivate a self that just gets better. So there's sort of a contrary motion thing going on in my life where, sure, my body is, I'm probably even sicker than I was 10 years ago, but I'm also smarter and I'm more well-read and I'm more articulate and I'm more patient and I'm gentler and I'm more tolerant. And, you know, I hope that that continues. And it, so I think that I discovered early in my disease that kind of my brain, my personality, my ability to express myself were kind of impervious to arthritis to some degree, and also what people were responding to in me. And I didn't really want to cultivate those things. I wanted to be, who doesn't want to be young and cute and able forever? But growing up is a process of realizing that those quieter, more durable aspects of yourself are of more value. So I don't love flashy piano music the same way, even to listen to the same way I did when I was young. When you're young, I grew up watching like Ripley's Believe It or Not, and you know, reading the Kids Did It section in World Magazine. I was really interested in these feats of dazzle. I'm just less interested in feats of dazzle now as an adult. I'm interested in, you know, quiet, long haul, durable contributions in the work I read and write and listen to. So I don't know how much of that is a product of illness or of my own kind of, if feats of dazzle were still possible for me, would I still be in love with them? Or have I sort of made that concession? I don't know. I'm middle-aged now. I'm 40 now. I'm just not as easily dazzled, but I'm dazzled by quieter things.
What do you hope that people will get from this book when they read it?
Well, I've been really gratified to get some messages from strangers on Facebook and through email and stuff. And just the other day, I got an email from a man who was a guitarist who got Guillain-Barré syndrome. So it can be a disabling condition. And he told me that the book spoke to him and that he is playing and he's playing. I think he used some beautiful metaphor I wish I'd written myself about, you know, music. You put in the blender that is your brain and you let it come out the way it comes out, incorporating your bodily experiences and your emotional experiences. And if it doesn't sound the way the composer intended it, or the way it was written, or the way some other fabulous recording artist recorded it, that's okay, because your rendition of it is informed by everything you've been through, and it's kind of more hard won than that. So just to get a message from a guitarist whose body has also made playing of his beloved instrument harder, but has made the music he makes on it richer, that's what I wanted out of this book. Was I wanted it to knit some of us together who are these musicians whose bodies have made our making music harder, but sweeter. But don't have to be a musician. If there's something you love and the path your life has taken you has imperiled that thing you love, the kind of fighting to keep it in your life, I want my book to reach those people too. And I want them to feel less alone. I wrote this book because a teacher told me you should write the book you want to read. I was writing terrible novels at the time. And I was kind of struggling and asked this teacher, like, I don't know where this is going or why I'm writing this. And he said, well, is that the book you want to read? You need to write the book you want to read. And so I wrote the book that I think would have consoled me when I was 17, picking a college and wondering at that point if I had to ratchet down my dreams. Or when, in that dark phase of the book that you mentioned, when I kind of was sort of kicked out of music, it felt, this book would have been comforting to me. It's not a self-help book. It's not a spiritual book per se. It doesn't have tips for, you know, managing your illness. It has tips for managing your life when your body mutinies. And the truth is, all of us are either in that position now or going to be. I mean, if you age, your body's going to change on you and might change some of your dreams. Or if you become ill or disabled, you're going to have to renegotiate an identity that includes the things you love with a body that kind of changed on you. I want it to reach those people, and I want it to knit us together, and I want them to continue writing to me to tell them if it did, because that has made this 10-year road with this book. And as you remember, the book is my way of being okay with not playing the piano. So when someone writes to me and says, your book spoke to me, that kind of chips away at the deficit of piano in my life.
Well, I want to thank you very much for swinging by the studio and saying hi to me and chatting about your book. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Andrea Avery is the author of Sonata, a memoir of pain and piano, published by Pegasus Books. And you can learn more about it when you visit classicalwcrb.org, where Chris has a few more thoughts about it and about his conversation with Andrea. If you've kept up with The Answered Question over the last couple of weeks, you've heard the first two segments of an interview with Richard Stoltzman. Kathy Fuller talked with him about the new release of 40 of his recordings in one box set. And now I've got the last segment for you, when Richard and Kathy finally get to what I think is a really important topic when it comes to Richard Stoltzman's playing, vibrato. As you'll hear, his use of vibrato hasn't always made his life easy, but there's genuine musicianship behind it, and I loved hearing him talk through the role that it plays. Here's the conversation with a bit of a kick to get us into it.
If I had told him, Dad, I'm going to be playing with Woody Herman's big band, he said, you made it. You did it. You really did it. You know, he would have been ecstatic.
That's clarinetist Richard Stoltzman remembering his recording with Woody Herman's Thundering Herd back in 1988 and how much his dad would have loved it. I'm Kathy Fuller. Richard Stoltzman played the very first clarinet recital ever at Carnegie Hall. He's won the big Avery Fisher Career Grant, 2 Grammys, and millions of fans over the years. And he's adventured into all kinds of music. There's just no one like him. And as much as he's feeling surprised by the arrival of his 75th birthday, he was even more surprised by the new box set of his complete RCA and Sony recordings on 40 CDs. I sat down with Richard Stoltzman to hear him tell a few of his many stories. In 1989, you made this recording, and Judy Collins had a couple of tracks on there.
Wow.
There's a great clip on YouTube of you on one of the morning shows with her, and I think it's Bill Douglas playing the piano.
Could be.
I was standing on a noisy corner, waiting for the walking green. Across the street he's
That's Judy Collins. Inner Voices is the name of that recording, and that's from 1989. That was the first time you brought a singer into your...
Right. I think it's... I've never recorded with singer.
Mm-hmm.
I've recorded all their songs, like the aria.
Yes, so yes.
I sing all their songs, but I've not sung them with them. I think it was just... I remembered her when... I mean, I guess we were probably pretty much the same age, but I remember her when I was at Cal Arts and hanging out a lot. And her words and music... seemed to just pervade the atmosphere of my life at that time. I was a single guy and thinking about what exactly am I supposed to be doing here? You know, I'm sort of teaching a little bit, but I don't know. And I play the clarinet, but like, who's listening to me? I'm in the middle of the desert out here at Cal Arts, you know? It was a kind of, just before I'd left to go to Cal Arts, I played one studio gig with an orchestra, and it was on a session called Whales and Nightingales, and that was a Judy Collins record. And the arranger had made a beautiful section for the clarinets in a kind of Brahmsian third, little section. And, it was my first time to ever record in that kind of vein. And I bought the record and listened to myself with Judy Collins, you know. And I guess so that started to think. And then Jeremy Wald, he was the one who found out that Judy wanted to record Joni Mitchell's tune. And he said... That's it. And,
wow.
And then he loved Bill's music, and he wanted Judy to sing a piece of Bill's on the record. And so that's how it turned out. And, and I added my two cents with when she sings a clarinet for free, then I sort of on purpose plays the beginning of the Brahms clarinet quintet. Just stick that in there. I thought, well... You know, I'm not on the street, but I'm going to play.
That's fantastic. Well, this is where we can talk about vibrato then. I mean, imitating a singer or being a singer. There was this great New York Times article about you, which began talking about you back in another life with your young family camping. And the thing that blew up the mattresses wasn't working, so you blew up six inflatable mattresses in like no time flat, and because you're a great clarinetist and it was easy for you. And then you had a dream that your family was sleeping on your breath. And that, I thought that was such a touching kind of vision. But then you talk about your breath. This is what you do. You give your breath out to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you've said things about vibrato that the sound isn't alive without it. Is that basically right? Vibrato is that natural shake that comes at the end of when someone sings, for instance.
Right. And I think I was tending to emulate the songs that my dad played of Frank Sinatra and, Tony Bennett a little bit, and Ella, of how they use the tone to shape the song. And also give the meaning of the word a little more poignancy, and that the vibrato wasn't a on and off thing, and it wasn't actually anything that was precise. It was affected by the emotions of the word and also by the breath of the singer, and oftentimes. It would be a straight tone that, say, Frank Sinatra would sing until just about the last second and a half, and he would add a little bit of whatever you want to call vibrato, quiver, or accent to the sound that just gave it, oh, that's Frank Sinatra, that's for sure. And I think that's the personality that I found in it.
Here is a sampling of you sort of singing. This is the song "My Funny Valentine." You're playing here with your son, the pianist Peter John Stoltzman. From 1997, Peter John Stoltzman playing the piano and his father, Richard Stoltzman, playing the clarinet. Really, you know, it's like those great Bill Evans tunes where you have to wait so long for the tune to kick in, you know? But it's so dramatic. This is such a, that's, is that your son who made that? He did that.
Yes.
Right. I remember you guys played that for us in the studio once.
Oh, really?
Yep, you did. We've got another version. There's that subtle vibrato in there. It just seems natural to me, very natural. Do people have problem with clarinets playing vibrato?
Totally, yes. In fact, I was ostracized pretty much all of my adult
life
for using vibrato. And pretty, yeah, I think clarinetists feel that it's a it dirties the sound, or it keeps the sound from being pure, or it's, I think, you know, it goes back to the days when Reginald Kell was playing classical clarinet in England, and he used vibrato in his tone, and this was considered an anathema to American clarinet players, and they ostracized him from their society, basically.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Wow. But he sort of had the last laugh, because then he did the first recordings of some of the great works for clarinet with great pianists like Mieczysław Rzhavsky.
So there. You did this great CD of arias you mentioned before.
Yeah.
Of course, now you're going to need to be acting like a singer. But there's this one thing with the is it Kalman Opperman? Is that
yeah,
how you
Kalman
say it?
Kalman.
That was your teacher.
Kalman Opperman.
And he has
this
amazing clarinet choir. Listen to this. You know, it takes a while for you to realize that these are all clarinets. I mean, there's nothing here but clarinets. But there's a groove here. No? Isn't there?
Yeah.
That's just so fantastic.
That's Cal Opperman. God bless Mika, my wife, for arranging the Weill Hall for his 90th birthday.
Oh.
And he was able to come. And he not only was able to come, but he was deciding what the music should be. I told him different things I thought would be nice. And he said, what about Opperman, all Opperman? Okay. So we did. But the last piece was Danny Boy with a Kalman Opperman clarinet choir. And his son brought him on the stage in a wheelchair, and he conducted this. But it was not in any way maudlin. It was, you know, like breathtakingly elegant and full of those little turns of phrases that singers do, but he made his whole choir do that with his stick. He had a great stick technique, and I'm sure anybody who was at that concert never forgot that. But this, he never talked about vibrato.
When did you study with him?
I studied with him from the time I left Yale, which was in 1967.
So you were in your mid-20s at that point.
Until when he died.
Wow. So he didn't talk about vibrato? How can that be?
No. There were a lot of things that he didn't talk about. He just did.
I see.
And he would sometimes say, just shut up, do what I do, you know, or do what I say. But then he would demonstrate, I mean, just play the clarinet, and he'd always play some Jewish melody or a ballad from some Broadway show that he was, because he worked for his life in the pit, and that's, he did that from 8 until 11, and then the rest of this time was his to teach and do whatever. And there was always this beautiful, beautiful singing quality, which he wouldn't tell you about, or he wouldn't say, you want to know how I sound like this? No, nothing.
Do you teach that way, demonstrably mostly?
Most of my clarinet students, I haven't had that many, probably, you know, like 15 or so in my life, but they don't want to know about it. They want to know about it, but they don't want to do it. They know that I'm doing it, and I'll go through all the kind of mechanical things about how this can happen, but mostly what I'm, if when I'm teaching or when I'm thinking about using the instrument, I'm thinking about the voice and singing. So I said, you know, you don't have to play with vibrato, but please take this line as da da dee da 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 dee da and sing it with your voice. Don't play it once. Now, you know, and they'll do it and they say, I can't sing. That's okay. You don't have to sing. And okay, now, try to make your clarinet sound like the way you sounded. And this is my goal, really, I think, with anybody, is find your sound. Where is that? Well, it's not in the technique. It's not in the reed. It's not even in the air. It's in the heartbeat and the part of ear. So that, and that'll be your sound when you use your ear, when you use your ear to listen to yourself and in reflection, listen to what you ideally would like to hear.
Well, you have collaborated with so many greats, Richard Good and the Tokyo Quartet, James Galway, Yo-Yo Ma, we haven't mentioned him. He thrives on collaborating, and he has always said he likes to be outside of his comfort zone. That's one of the things I remember him telling me, that musically he's best when he's outside of his comfort zone. Are you like that?
No.
You'd rather be in there.
I want to always be as comfortable as possible. And I would say what Yo-Yo probably means is he wants people to challenge him.
I see.
And he wants to be around people who aren't just going to kowtow to him. He wants people to say, you do this, you do that, and try it.
Yo-Yo Ma, Emmanuel Axe, and Richard Stoltzman playing Brahms, the clarinet trio. Brahms always is there in your life. I get the feeling that he's just kind of a part of what you are.
Yeah, okay, so I'll tell you this. My idea is that Mika and I told you we went to Hamburg to visit the birthplace of Brahms, and they had a little place there to show some of his early manuscripts and everything. And they had a picture of Richard Muehlfeldt. I'd never seen a picture of Richard Muehlfeldt.
What did he look like?
Well, he looked like a dude, you know?
I mean, this is the man who inspired Brahms out of retirement, played the clarinet so beautifully somehow that Brahms wrote his greatest chamber piece.
Right, and, you know, he's young, much younger, I think, probably 23 years younger than Brahms. But, I mean, everybody had a beard, so he had a beard. But what's Madonna say? He had a stance,
a pose.
Whatever that, you know, he looked like he knew he was good. And but I found this out about him, which is, may not be true, but I'm passing it on all the time anyway, that he was a violinist. He studied violin, and clarinet, picked up the clarinet later. So my opinion is that Brahms heard plenty of clarinet players because he wrote for them in the orchestra and everything. But he was retired and said, that's it. And then he heard Richard Muehlfeldt's clarinet. And what did Richard Muehlfeldt play like? We don't know, but he taught himself. So what did he teach himself from? From his experience of playing the violin. Therefore, my feeling is that Brahms heard, well, this guy, and he tried to tell the clarinet, he's like a nightingale or some kind of singing bird. So I think Brahms, for the first time, heard the tone of the clarinet, but with the life of vibrato in it. Hmm. And this was it. And ba-dum! Opus 114, Opus 115, Opus 120, number 1 and 2, and thank God, praise the Lord, hallelujah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Sounds absolutely believable to me.
Okay.
I believe you.
Just don't pass it on to anybody.
Well, so far, so here's your life in this box, and there are so many recordings I can't get to. The Great Brazil recording, all these fabulous things that it's so nice to learn, too, that I learned just now today with you, is that you really kind of pulled your hair out over which ones you wanted in this box.
They didn't ask me anything, really, about it, but they did give credit to everybody on the records. And that was the most important thing to me. What really pisses me off about the cloud and all that is that you get this stuff down from the cloud and you just listen to it and snap your fingers or close your eyes or whatever you do. But you don't realize all the people that are making this. There's a name of everybody in Woody's band. I'm so excited about
that.
When I made the record, RCA didn't put their names on.
They
didn't, because I said, what the? Well, you're doing this. And they said, well, this is usually our policy is the band, or not the band, but the ensemble. We don't list the individual names of the people of the ensemble.
Wow.
So they've got all their names in there. And Claire Fisher, with the Brazilian guys, all the percussion players, anyway, the guys,
they're there
and their names are there, and it's in a box and it's not in the cloud. And I feel so gratified to have all these people recognized.
Well, we are gratified that this is so available now. It's the 40 CD set, Richard Stoltzman. And I'm going to ask you to sign mine. You can sign it on the red part on the inside. It's called The Complete RCA Album Collection. Of course, Richard Stoltzman has so much more to do. He has this great duo with your wife, Mika Stoltzman.
Yeah.
The marimbist and teaching you the groove.
Teaching me the groove and making me wake up to reality that life is going on. And their composers that she, you know, went down to New York a couple of weeks ago. John Zorn, great New York composer. I don't know anything about him, you know. But she said, John, you could write a piece for me. He did. It's on our CD. And last couple of weeks, she's, could you write a piece for both of us, maybe? He said, sure. When? Well, when would you like it? Ah, my God. And so Mika is having sort of my... the 75th sort of a thing at Zankel Hall in New York.
That's next year. That's this year.
No, this year. November 7th. And John Zorn said, I'll write it for this occasion. And so Mika's also getting me out, you know. I'm I've gone to the Regatta Bar, but I've never played in a regatta. But she's got us going to the Regatta Bar.
It's about time.
Well, yeah. So it's kicking butt.
Richard Stoltzman, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Kathy, is this being recorded?
The 40-CD set of recordings by Richard Stoltzman has just been released by Sony, and to learn more about it, visit classicalwcrv.org. Remember, the answered question will be on summer vacation until later this year, and over the next several weeks, I hope you'll have the chance to hear some of the episodes of TAQ from this last season, along with the BSO and in-concert on-demand broadcasts that most of these podcasts are about. To get started, head to iTunes or SoundCloud or to our website, classicalwcrb.org. Thank you to Richard Stoltzman and Andrea Avery, as well as to my fabulous colleagues, Kathy Fuller and Chris Voss. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.